Good afternoon. It's nice to be here at King's and see each of you. My name is David Goa. I'm the director of the Chester Ronning Center for the Study of Religion and Public Life on the Augustana campus of the University of Alberta. And it's always a particular pleasure to partner with our friends at the King's University College. Not often at the University of Alberta we get to identify with the King of Kings. These days we don't even get to identify with the Queen all that often. I met our speaker today, Kamal Argan, in Syria back in the spring when a group of us were traveling there. He has recently received his PhD from a sort of joint offering from Hartford Seminary, which some of you may be familiar with in Connecticut, which has had a very long-running program, I think the longest in America, on Islamic studies for a Christian seminary. Hartford Seminary and the University of Exeter. He has a wide range of interests, which include Islam in the 20th century. He's also very interested in the mystical traditions of Islam and Sufism, the devout life, what it really means to become a saint, the whole models of sanctity in religious traditions and in Christian-Muslim conversation. And he's published on interfaith dialogue as well. His doctoral dissertation looks at the roots of Islam in Pakistan, Islamism in Pakistan. He's examined both the intellectual sources of these political movements as well as had the opportunity to do field research work and to get to meet some of the key actors in those movements. So I'm delighted that you're here with us and that we can engage you in some conversation after listening to you today. So welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for a warm reception. I'm gratified to be here today, and I flew in from Boston, so I'm fighting off jet lag, and I'm also fighting off a cold, and I'll try to keep my voice up so that everyone in the back row can hear me. I'm going to talk for about 45 minutes or so, and let people ask questions after that so we can get a discussion on these topics moving forward. What I'm going to present today is the core of my doctoral dissertation, which I've researched and written over the past 5 years at the University of Exeter in cooperation with Hartford Seminary down in Hartford, Connecticut. And I can tell you a little bit of my own story. My professor and my advisor said, you know, you should do a PhD. And he suggested studying Pakistan because Pakistan is a major center in the Muslim world for Islamic resurgence. And then he suggested that I study Islamisms in Pakistan. And of course, there's no amorphous green blob of Islamism in Pakistan. We're talking about people and institutions. And as I researched this more and more, it became clear that I'm going to have to do an intellectual biography of one fellow whom I had the chance to interview, named Khurshid Ahmad. Dr. Khurshid Ahmad, Senator Dr. Professor Khurshid Ahmad, is a Pakistani gentleman who lives in Islamabad. He's in his 70s now. Khurshid Ahmad is a vice president, Naib Amir, of the Jamaat-e Islami. The Jamaat-e Islami is a major Islamist institution in Pakistan. He's also president of the Institute of Policy Studies, which is a think tank and also something of a lobby. Khurshid Ahmad is a presence also in the public sphere within Pakistan on cable television. He regularly writes for the printout of the Jamaat-e-Islami and also for newspapers. So he is a presence in the public sphere. He has been a presence in the Pakistani government in the past, which I'll get into. The other fellow, Israr Ahmad, is a much more prominent presence in the public sphere in Pakistan. Israr Ahmad regularly talks on cable television, and I would say most Pakistanis probably know who he is. He is a Quranic scholar. He's somebody who's devoted his life. He left being a medical doctor to go off and study the Quran and to form a couple of organizations, the Association for the Servants of the Quran in Karachi. Israr Ahmad has an Islamist ideology, which I'll describe. Javed Ahmed Ghamidi is another scholar. Javed Ahmed Ghamidi is a regular presence on cable television in Pakistan. He was also involved in the government organ, the Council of Islamic Ideology. And he presents an interesting contrast. Whether or not to include him on a dissertation about Islamism was questionable, because some people would call him a modernist or an anti-Islamist, but I'll explain my reasons for including him in the study. All three of these scholars trace their lineage back to a major presence in Pakistan, Abul Ala Maududi. Maududi did most of his writing back in the 1930s. He was a journalist. He was a graduate of the Deobandi school, which is a modern revivalist school, one of the two major schools in Pakistan, the Deobandi and the Barelwi schools. It seems that Abul Ala Maududi veiled his connections with the Deobandi sodality, or the Deobandi school, and promoted his ideas about Islamic revival in different journalistic venues, different journals. He wrote books, seemingly to make contact with the widest number of people, and he had a tremendous impact. However, he should be understood in a historical context. Before Maududi, one of the major modernists was Sayyid Ahmad Khan in the 1800s, late 1800s. And Sayyid Ahmad Khan was trying to put together an Islamic ideology that would be consistent with British rule. So a modernist rule. This opened up the possibility of a discourse on Islamic law. Okay, so that for most of the Islamic scholars, Islamic law was something that's static. The gates of Sharia were closed in the 1200s. And what Sayyid Ahmad Khan did was he showed that there's a way to look at this which is modern. He was criticized for this, some aspects of his ideology. I won't get into all that now, but what he did was he opened the door. He opened the door for people like Muhammad Iqbal. Muhammad Iqbal, if you go to Islamabad, you'll see there's a major mausoleum for him there. He's the poet par excellence of Pakistan. Unfortunately, he died in 1938, but by far one of the greatest thinkers in the Muslim world. What he did was he promoted the idea of homeland for the Muslims. And it's my understanding that he promoted that within several states of North India. Nowadays, he's credited in Pakistan as promoting the Pakistan idea. Muhammad Iqbal had contact with Maududi. Maududi claimed to be influenced by Muhammad Iqbal. He also had contact with Muhammad Ali Jinnah. However, Abul Ala Maududi and Jinnah were two different kinds of people. Jinnah formed the Muslim League, which is by far a much larger party. Maududi did not trust Muhammad Ali Jinnah. He saw Muhammad Ali Jinnah as a secular Muslim, wanting to create a homeland for the Muslims, but not an Islamic state. This was the ideology of Maududi, as with all of the Islamists, that the way to create an Islamic society, that's the end game of Islamism, is done top-down. It's necessary to control the political system and the judicial system. If I describe some of the main principles of Maududi's ideology, it's clearer to understand. There's six principles. First is the ineffable and undisputed sovereignty of God. You see this in the Islamist writing. God is sovereign. That means that God's will and God's law is what we should be following. This does not allow for, in the Islamist interpretation, for a post-enlightenment interpretation of God's laws. It has to be Sharia. It has to be something derived from the Quran and the Sunnah. So Islam is a private religion that we practice within a secular system. Absolutely not. This is why Maududi did not want to work together with Muhammad Ali Jinnah. At partition, independence and partition between Pakistan and India, it's itself the subject, could be the subject of a whole PhD dissertation. This is very complex. It looks like Maududi wanted to create some kind of state for the Muslims within India. He didn't want to create a separate Pakistan. He didn't support the Pakistani idea, or the idea of Pakistan. He did after partition. He became very pro-Pakistani. He moved his headquarters to Lahore. He formed in 1941, before partition, the Jamaat-e-Islami. They put an ad in some of the major journals and brought together all the major scholars who joined and followed his writings, his journalistic writings. This culminated in ultimately Maududi moving the main offices to Pakistan and giving up on the idea of any kind of Islamic state in India, and ultimately working to establish the Jamaat-e-Islami, the main Islamist party, through the electoral process. There was never the idea of a violent takeover. There was never the idea of a violent takeover or a not working through the electoral process. This is an important point because it's where Israr Ahmad broke off. Israr Ahmad was originally within the Jamaat-e-Islami, working with Maududi, claims to be inspired by Maududi. Everybody claims to be inspired by Maududi. But Israr Ahmad promotes a different idea. It is Islam through revolution. This is one of the ideas that Maududi appropriates. There's two major ideas that he appropriates or misappropriates. One of democracy and revolution. And this can be critiqued. What Maududi talks about with democracy has been criticized by Vali Nasr, a major Vali Nasr is a major scholar who writes about the Jamaat-e-Islami and also about Maududi, is that democracy is essentially a cover for Maududi's ideology. And you see this in Khurshid Ahmad's writings. Khurshid Ahmad is essentially the protege of Maududi. Khurshid Ahmad, when I interviewed him, talked about how at an early point in his life, Maududi had a tremendous influence on him. And they worked together. He was his main protege. and Khurshid Ahmad in his ideology since essentially reiterates. We see this in an article from 2000 in the Muslim World Journal, Islam and Democracy. Excuse me. He references Khurshid's main writing. Khurshid Ahmad references Maududi's main writing from the 1950s, which describes Islamic law and constitution, the whole system of Islamic government, and essentially reiterates this and says about democracy that this will be a caliphate of all believers. So they take the old idea of the Islamic caliphate and say we must have a caliphate, or a caliph, khilafah, but it will be of all the Muslims. Or not all the Muslims, all the believers. That's plurality. That's democracy. And he describes it in very utopian terms. This will be Islamic justice. This will be Sharia instituted. And because it's perfect, it's democracy. That was the critique. I believe Khurshid Ahmad is more sophisticated. He's written a book on proportional representation in Pakistan where he describes all of the different European systems of democracy, their advantages and disadvantages. So he knows very well what the political systems of democracy are in the West. It was Iqbal's idea, and Muhammad Iqbal describes this, that there should be proportional representation. There should be elected assemblies. And they all of the three figures agree on this. There should be some kind of democracy. Isfar Ahmad differentiates on this. He's promoting the idea of a caliphate, but it's much more authoritarian. First Pakistan, and then from Pakistan reaching outward to all the world. The whole world must be Islamized. And the sense that I get is that the Shura, the representative assembly in Pakistan, is advisory. The caliph decides. The caliph is one man. And this is controlled, or there's a quality control by the Supreme Court in Isfar Ahmad's ideology. So the basis is the Quran and Sunnah, the Sharia, the institution of Sharia. I believe Khurshid Ahmad's model is actually more democratic. It actually believes in working through the electoral process that exists now in Pakistan and keeping that model in place. Javed Ghamidi critiques this. He says, yes, there's a caliphate, but the caliphate is not explicit in classical Islam. And he says the same thing that Muhammad Khalid Masood says, Muhammad Khalid Masood being the president of the Council of Islamic Ideology, and that is that this whole Islamist ideological formation is something from the 20th century. It was never part of classical Islam. Yes, a caliphate is mentioned, but it's not explicated the way Maududi explicated it, that it has to be this way. Javed Ahmad Ghamidi says that a caliphate just means the political system. It's whatever the successorship is. He also describes that there is a natural impetus amongst Muslims to want to establish a just government. Khurshid Ahmad tells me this. When polled, 69% of the Pakistani people wanted a society based on Quran and Sunnah. And his implication was that means they want an Islamic state. Javed Ghamidi would disagree. He'd say, yes, we want a Quran and Sunnah, but this ideology of the Islamic state, that's something else that we can talk about. To continue on with the characteristics of Maududi's ideology, the caliphate of all the believers, as I already mentioned. These Muslim caliphs are all pious practicing Muslims. Now we run into a problem here. Who is a pious practicing Muslim? And you run into a major problem with identity issues in Pakistan. Pakistan has five different major identities. If you look at it geographically, the Muhajirs who emigrated from India, from all over India, Indian Muslims, Punjabis, Baluchistan, the Baluchis, the Pakhtun or Pashtun from the northwest frontier provinces, and the Sindhis. Not only that, but you have Sunni Muslims, somewhere between 7 to 15% Shiite, Ismailis, Ahmadis. So if you say it's that simple, we're instituting Sharia, they ran into a problem with this. Zia-ul-Haq attempted to institute Sharia, and he used a Sunni definition. He used the ideology of Maududi, borrowed from Maududi very heavily. And there was protests in the streets from the Shiites. And they ran up against ethno-nationalist parties like the Pakistan People's Party, a leftist party from Sindh. And Zia-ul-Haq ran into all kinds of problems with this. It's not as simple as saying we want to set up an Islamic government, we're going to institute Sharia, and we all agree on that. This harkens back to the history of Pakistan, and this is where Pakistan is dealing with the post-colonial reality. The time of the British was a time where the old Mughal system was disestablished. The period of time that Sharia was actually discursive and not an imposed rigid doctrine came to an end. Anglo-Mohammedan law was a system of British judges who took a Sunni Sharia book and a Shiite Sharia book and said, well, are you Sunni or Shiite? If you're Sunni, we'll apply these principles in the case of family law. If you're Shiite, we'll apply these principles. It was not discursive. The Islamic judges were disestablished. It became a private practice. It was no longer something public. It was imposed. And it continued to be imposed after the British left. It was not discursive. With Zia-ul-Haq, it was not democratic. It was not pluralistic. There was protests in the streets. The fourth characteristic that Maududi talks about is that consultation is enjoined, shura. There has to be a democratic consultation. Democratic by whose definition? Who can be part of that shura? What are the parameters of the discourse? The fifth characteristic that we see with Maududi's ideology is that political leaders and administrators must be not only competent but pious, and they can't eagerly seek office. They can't be ambitious. So they're pious, again, by whose definition? Islam is comprehensive. It's public and private. It's not just a private practice. And if public life falls short of this Islamist idea, society lapses into the state that existed before Islam, the state of ignorance, jahiliya. That's what the Islamists say they're trying to overcome, the state of ignorance. When I first began encountering How are we on time? 15 minutes. When I first began encountering studies of Pakistan and descriptions, there were these labels: Islamism, modernists, fundamentalists. And there's no real discrete way of determining who's a modernist, who's a fundamentalist, who's a reformist. The term fundamentalism has its own debate. There's a history of debate around what a fundamentalist is and who is an Islamist. And we can find some description of this. Martin Kramer wrote an article on this, on the history of the use of the term Islamism and fundamentalism. Fundamentalism comes from a Christian debate. It's been used to describe Christians. I don't think it's applicable. I don't think it really says anything, especially not for these three. Islamism is an old French term for people who wanted to establish Islam, and then it was revived in journalistic circles. But it still is hard to define who is an Islamist, who is a fundamentalist. Muslims agree on fundamentals. All three of these scholars agree that they want to establish the fundamental Islamic society. It's a question of how. When I talked with Khurshid Ahmad in 2008, he says, I don't want to work together with him. He's gone too far. People call him a modernist or a liberal. He refuses to work with them. Yet both of them passionately feel that Pakistan should be an Islamic society. What I did to answer this question was I kept seeing a recurring description of what I would call a continuum between two polarities or two modalities, one of guidance and one of governance. I saw this with Metcalf, Barbara Metcalf, who writes about Pakistan, also Pervez Mansour, also Mahmoud Manjikuri, who writes about human rights in Pakistan. Also Ibrahim Aburabi, who is here at the University of Alberta. So there is a guidance-governance continuum, and it's been there for a long time. So the guidance, what we might call the Sufi, or the non-politically oriented Sufis, who see that Islam is a question of the heart, as opposed to the Islamists who say, it's not just a question of the heart, but it's a question of how do we govern the whole society. Within that continuum, we can place people, more or less, using discrete criteria. And what I do is borrow from Mumtaz Ahmad, who wrote for the Fundamentalisms Project. And he describes criteria that are very similar to Maududi's. First, that they seek to restore the original teachings of the Quran and Sunnah, and to recreate the socio-religious system established under the direct guidance of the Prophet and his first four successors, the rightly guided caliphs. These are Sunnis, not Shiites. Second, the Islamists tend to reject, he says, fundamentalists. I switch out Islamists for where he says fundamentalists. They tend to reject later developments in Islamic history. At least in theory they do. In reality, the Jamaat-e-Islami, you will see them building consensus in Pakistan. They also reject institutional structures of later development. You see this with Khurshid Ahmad and Isfar Ahmad. They criticize the remnants of British culture, the British educational system. The remnant of British culture where Islam is a private religion. The political system, the post-colonial system. They reject this. They want to set up an Islamic system, which is an ideology that was put together in the 20th century. They uphold the right to ijtihad and fresh thinking on matters not directly covered in the teachings of the Quran and Sunnah. So jurisprudence is still open. They uphold the right on it, and in fact they do it. This is a point in Mumtaz Ahmad's critique which assumes that ijtihad is closed. In fact, if you talk to Sunni scholars, they'll tell you it's possible to do ijtihad. It's not closed. It's still open. Islamists differ from conservative ulama on a fourth point, the concept of deen, which they interpret as a way of life. Islam is a complete way of life. There is no part of life which is not covered by Islam, including the political system. There's also a revitalized formalism. You see this in Maududi's writings from the 1950s. He describes essentially Sunni practices. All of these scholars are not particularly pro-Shiite or very accommodating of Shiism or of Ahmadiyya or of Ismailis. I also don't think they're very accommodating of Christians. And sadly, this is one of the points where you see that they're reacting to the colonial reality. They see Christians in Pakistan as Hindus who accepted the religion of the colonizers. And this is the main reason why Christians in Pakistan suffer persecution. Although when I asked Khurshid Ahmad directly about this, he deflected the question. None of these people directly come out and say, we persecute Christians as a matter of policy. But the reality in Pakistan is that it happens, unfortunately. Lastly, the leaders of all these movements are lay scholars. They're not orthodox ulama. They're not clergy. They're Western trained, or they're trained from a system that was created by the West. They're trained by the university system. Khurshid Ahmad is an economist. He's a Muslim economist. Isra Ahmad is a medical doctor. And Javed Ghamidi is a graduate of the university system. However, these two differentiate from Khurshid Ahmad in that they're following a very interesting scholar, Amin Hassan Islahi, who sees the Quran as a consistent whole. Khurshid Ahmad is a lot like Maududi, in that he borrows a lot of Western methodology. And this was Vali Nasr's critique of the Jamaat-e-Islami. If you look at the Jamaat-e-Islami, Maududi was reading a lot about Stalinist communism when he put together the Jamaat-e-Islami, the organizational form. It's a Western party from the 1930s. He was reading a lot about Russian communism, reading Western books. They don't advertise this, but he's very influenced by Western ideas. Isra Ahmad critiques Islamists in general for this, that they have adopted Western ideas. And they've adopted Western ideas. And that they've lost a spiritual basis for what they're doing. And he claims to be returning to the original foundation of the Jamaat-e-Islami. He keeps the Jamaat-e-Islami organizational form, having split off in the 1950s, to that of being a holy community. And he critiques Khurshid Ahmad and the present Jamaat-e-Islami as being involved in party politics and becoming de-spiritualized. So Ghamidi criticizes the agenda to establish an Islamic state, but the end game is there. And the end game is still there with Khurshid Ahmad. They did not gain in the elections. They boycotted the last elections. And when I interviewed Khurshid Ahmad, he said, we have other strategies besides electoral politics of influencing the society to achieve our agenda. They were largely criticizing the injustices of the Pervez Musharraf regime, the military regime. They were promoting the agenda of the Islamic lawyers in Pakistan, or the Pakistan Lawyers Association. He says we have street power. And he goes back to Maududi's principles of not only wanting to set up an Islamic state, but also work on identity, work through education, through the madrasa systems. This is also a point of differentiation between the three. Isfar Ahmad is much more critiquing of regional identities, critical of regional identities. And this has to do with the breakoff of Bangladesh, where Bangladesh broke off from West Pakistan in 1971. And he sees Islam as unifying all these disparate nationalities. There's a revolution, there's a transformation of people where they're no longer pursuing ethno-nationalism. Okay? And this is where Zia-ul-Haq was so ready to exploit Islamism, because he did not want the leftist ethno-nationalist party, the Pakistan People's Party, that Bhutto controlled, controlling Sindh and possibly breaking off. He wanted to use Islamism to unite, to neutralize the regional identities, and to the extent that they would oppose the centralization of power. All of these parties are critiqued by people like Olivia Roy, if I pronounce them correctly, Olivia Roy, if I mispronounce them in English, where he says Islamisms are reaching a dead end. You know, this is old rhetoric and feeble glosses, and it's not happening. Fuad Zakaria down in Egypt, an Egyptian secularist scholar, says there's always a human interpretation. Okay, that's God's word, but there's always a human interpreting it. You're going to say that this is God's kingdom that you're installing, but there's people interpreting God's law. It's an impossibility. Sharia is too complex in today's world to set up an Islamic state like it was during the time of the first four caliphs, like the Islamists are saying we should get back to. Ramadi critiques, he says they're running out of steam. The other people critique, the Western scholars critique, Olivia Roy, Fuad Zakaria in Egypt. And the Islamists say, we'll take the street power. We still have the objective, we're not giving up. I think one person who offers a perspective which provides a future for all of these people is Muhammad Khalid Massoud of the Council of Islamic Ideology. He's by far one of the smartest people I interviewed in Pakistan. And he talks about something that he calls the social construction of Sharia. So as opposed to a legalistic imposition of Sharia, which is what happened in Anglo-Mohammedan law, which is what happened in a severe way to the detriment of women and minorities in Pakistan under the Zia-ul-Haq administration, could be reversed, could be corrected into something non-authoritarian by returning Sharia to its discursive state. It's a discourse in the public sphere. It's negotiated. And all of these people have a right to be part of that discourse, if it's going to be a democracy, if it's going to be pluralistic. They provide content in all of their writings. They're in the public sphere. They're less and less in the official sphere, but people watch them on TV. People enjoy watching them. They're a presence. They're not gone. The Maududi ideology continues in the Jamaat-e-Islami, with Khurshid Ahmad, it continues with Isfar Ahmad. Javed Ahmad Ghamidi, to a certain extent, he provides a contrast. It's a different group of people. It's people that we would call liberal, middle class, following him not as a member organization, but as an intellectual school. That discourse in the public sphere can point all of these people and the people of Pakistan in a direction not of an imported Western democracy, but a democracy, a pluralistic discourse that is established according to Pakistani parameters. It's not imposed by a Western power. It's not imposed by America or the British or the Soviet Union. It's something the Pakistanis put together. I'm reminded of one major scholar, his name escapes me, it's the jet lag, describing the demographics of Pakistan, that there's about 160 or 170 million Pakistanis, a roughly equal number of Muslims in India. The majority are poor, but there's about 30 million that are either affluent or middle class. And we see these people when they immigrate here. They're educated, they're professionals. And at this point, I would say that Pakistan has enough people who understand what modernity is. They have enough people who understand what a modern political system is. And they're capable of effectuating a pluralistic discourse in the public sphere, like the Pakistani scholar Muhammad Khalid Masood says. And that was the point of my dissertation, is that all of these people can be useful in that context. These are not the enemies of freedom. These are not the Islamo-fascists that need to be gotten rid of before democracy can happen in Pakistan. All of these people are capable of providing momentum for that pluralistic discourse as they move away from the official sphere and into the public sphere. Thank you very much.
From astonishing, Ali Shawa raises his hand. Good to see you, Ali.
Thank you.
Please.
I would like to know what is the impact left by Abdul Ala and Maududi and his followers on today's Islam? How is the connection and how it is going with today's Islam?
Well, I interviewed a Pakistani sociologist at Qaidi Azam University named Tariq Rahman, who looks at education, that is the madrasa system. And if you look at it from education, the rich people in Pakistan are putting their kids in English schools. They're studying Western curricula. And it looks like it's the poor who go to the madrasas where this ideology is taught. When I asked Tariq Rahman what's the import of Maududi, what's the impact, he said it's been tremendous. I asked other scholars, what is the import of Maududi? Is he passé? And the response was, we miss him. We really miss him. He was sincere. He also impacted Sayyid Qutb. People read his articles throughout the Muslim world. He's read in Malaysia. The Jamaat-e-Islami has spin-off organizations or sister organizations where the ideology of Maududi is the original publications continue to be published and people read. I would say in every Islamist organization, Maududi is a figure. Sayyid Qutb is also a figure.
Say just a word about who that is.
Sayyid Qutb.
No, just in case some people are not aware of it.
Founding ideologue of the Egyptian Islamic Brotherhood.
Brother was the teacher of Osama bin Laden.
I think Zawahiri comes out of Islamic Brotherhood. Yes.
I personally, I don't believe in Osama bin Laden.
You're not.
I don't believe in his work because he was made to do what he is doing today, and he was made by the CIA and the Saudi Arabian government.
None of these figures espouse violence. None of them.
Khurshid Ahmad, Iskar Ahmad, Jabhat Ahmad Gandhi.
Now, in theory, his model provides for violence, Iskar Ahmad. But he has said it's not practicable in today's setting, so we're not promoting violence. Jabhat Ahmad Gandhi is pretty clear. No violence. The jihadists are a different phenomenon. And who's behind them gets very complex and very interesting. You never know who's behind violent organizations. And there's also an identity difference. These people are the mainstream. I was interviewing Khurshid Ahmad at his offices in Islamabad, and we heard this big kaboom. And we're wondering, what was that? Was that the water heater downstairs? And then we were watching on the news. That was the Danish embassy. The Danish embassy got bombed when I was there interviewing him. He had nothing to do with it. It was these extremists who promote violence. And the whole phenomenon in Afghanistan is scary. Yes?
I have heard the word Ahmadiyya from your mouth. You have mentioned Ahmadiyya.
Yes.
I just want to know to what extent you have studied this movement and what was your source of information about this movement.
So my source of information about the Ahmadiyya movement is the Ahmadiyya webpage.
Ahmadiyya?
There's an Ahmadiyya webpage, an official Ahmadiyya webpage, which specifically is anti-Maududist. They critique the Maududist or Maududite ideology directly. They do that by quoting Orthodox Sunni ulama's critiques of Maududi. So they reiterate the Indian ulama from before partition, their critiques of Maududi. And their critiques of Maududi were essentially that Maududi was not a deep Islamic scholar. He's a journalist promoting an ideology.
You've expressed some concerns to me about the way in which Pakistan and a number of these thinkers in Pakistan, their response to the Ahmadiyyas. Say a little bit about that, about how you see that. I think our friends would be in.
I didn't specifically ask Khurshid Ahmad, Mr. Ahmad, or Jabhat Ghamidi about this.
That's fine. You can still say something.
I think it's pretty clear. It's been very well documented. The Ahmadiyya have been targeted for oppression. They've been targeted for violence. I can speculate on what's happening. And I would speculate that it's essentially an attitude that comes out of the time of colonialism, where they see Christianity, they see that is Christianity within Pakistan, they see Ahmadiyya as consistent with, somehow, or products of the British period.
Is it your conclusion or it is their opinion?
They didn't express their opinion to me. But when I look at this and I wonder, why is it that the Ahmadiyya are such targets for intolerance?
Okay, if we have time, I can tell you. But this movement was established in 1889. So Jamaat Islami was established long after.
Yes.
And why they are doing, they should know. But this is not the reason.
What's your opinion, may I ask you?
Actually, now I am coming to build religion, not this movement. If you read history of religions, you will find that there is always acceptance and opposition to any movement, religious movement, political movement. But if you read the history of Prophet Muhammad or Jesus or Moses, you will find that the opposition against any true prophet always surpasses. This is the thing. This happened in the time of Moses, this happened in the time of Jesus, this happened with Prophet Muhammad himself, and this is what is happening in us. But they always keep their next things. But this is the real thing.
Can I add this one thing? Which the way I feel is that the concept of jihad, which Founder Fahmiyyah community promoted, is directly opposite to what Maududi and his philosophy developed later on. Mm-hmm. And I have seen personally myself that whenever something big bang is going to happen, they generally prosecute them with more. It happened in Turkey, it happened in other countries, that they highlight. Because we are the only group, family group, who could fight this on a religious basis, that this violence is not permitted in Islam. And I think, I remember the time when People's Party, MBS supported Bhutto, for example, for that reason that they are non-religious, so they believe in freedom for everybody. And Maududi's group came to us that at that time they were promoting that we will kick you out of this country, you have no right to live, I mean killing, but if you vote for us, then you know we will allow you to live peacefully.
Just for the sake of others, came to us, you mean came to the Ahmadiyyas?
Exactly.
Yes.
I was at that time involved in
part of the Ahmadiyyas.
Exactly, yeah. That's right, yeah. Right. So I think the very good analysis you have presented, I really like the way you interview these people. But the current context, what's happening now in Afghanistan and other countries, the way Islam is viewed, the fundamental philosophy of Maududi, which is still promoted, is that if nothing else works, you have a right to establish God's kingdom by violence. You could kill in the name of God. And that's what we oppose. And that's what we are being persecuted. That we are the biggest hindrance they feel that on a religious level. And that's why they have all the laws against MDs, that we cannot call ourselves MDs, you can't do this, you can't use Islamic name, all the persecution. I find that is the basic reason. And the other problem is the system of Khilafah, which you mentioned. They are waiting for that one day they will wake up and suddenly a political messiah will come and everything will be resolved and Muslim will go to their glory. Mm. That's not going to happen. So when Ahmadiyyas are organized as a Khilafah system, they feel a threat and that they already have a Khilafah based on a principle of their own. So I think those are the two reasons which I feel are very, very interesting.
You know, when people are exploiting religion for political reasons, they co-opt the dogma. They find theological reasons. And if there was no outside influences or political exploitation of religion, my theory is that Ahmadiyya and Sunnis would get along just fine. And Shiites would get along just fine.
Yeah.
But there has been so much foreign interests. Okay, they're surrounded by China, India, Afghanistan. After the British waned away, the CIA took an interest in Pakistan, and the military government of Pakistan is, I think, major reasons why the military is so strong. We in America, south of the border, wanted Pakistan as a base, as an Air Force base against the Soviet Union. So why is it that theological reason? I think on its own people can find ways to get on their own people can find ways to get along, but there's a context which is forcing this kind of intolerant attitude, which is wrong. The Shiite fellow I talked to said he wants a secular system. It's the only way. You have to have a secular system. Otherwise, we will be driven out. We will be persecuted out of Pakistan. And this, the Pakistani Shiites I talked to are suffering.
One of the quick parts I give that the Ahmadiyya Jamaat, the community, they have believed and decided that the religion of Islam will be separate from the government from in future, that the religion will be involved more personal, you know, on a social level, moral, those sort of things, and the mullahs would not rule the country. They are immature, they can't do that. So religion will be kept separate from the government. So this one of the other interesting things that I find.
If I could just provide a little footnote to that.
Yeah.
You have talked about this thinking in some cases where there is a concern for Islam to form the social sphere, to shape the identity of people, but not for it to necessarily, if I understood, necessarily be the direct governmental tool. That, of course, is an issue that that informs the thinking of a number of intellectuals in the Christian West as well. And I would be interested in you saying just a little bit more about that. And I'd be particularly interested in some of our colleagues here who have thought about that matter in a particular Christian context, to perhaps pick up on that a little bit and see what happens across that boundary.
Well, the majority of Pakistanis, if we believe the research, 69% want Quran and Sunnah to be the basis of the society. And you were mentioning excluding mullahs. And there's people who want Ahmadiyya to be excluded, and there's people who want Shiites to be excluded, and there's people who want secularists to be excluded, and there's people who want Christians to be excluded. That's not democracy. That's not pluralism. The public sphere was described by Habermas, the theory for that. And he describes it in a Western post-Enlightenment setting. Muhammad Ali Massoud is saying, we're never going to get that. That was the colonial period which caused all these problems, which we're still dealing with, like partition. They need to have a public sphere which functions according to Pakistani parameters. My hope is that that would include all the people who are Pakistanis. But then they can negotiate this in a discourse instead of hard negotiation, intolerant negotiation.
How does this fall on the ears of you, Kaipurans?
Yeah, some of the principles that you mentioned, right? That idea that nothing held outside, you know, God's absolute sovereignty and so on. I think one of the crucial things is that, or in this particular Christian tradition, I don't know if you know Abraham Kuyper or anything.
Here's your chance.
It's a way of trying to reconcile the idea that God is sovereign over all, there is no part of society or including governance and so on that should fall outside of that, with a kind of pluralistic democracy, is the idea that somehow it is that commitment to pluralistic democracy is intrinsic to Christian faith and the sovereignty of God.
Uh-huh.
Right? That to make that's the crucial connection. And that's actually something I'm wondering about, because you mentioned all three of these figures, right? Should be we can call on allies to a sort of pluralistic democratic discourse in Pakistan. Right? But are they each somehow committed to pluralism as an intrinsic Islamic value? Or merely to its engaging in pluralistic dialogue, or indeed in parliamentary governance, is simply a good, effective, probably just the easiest way or the most likely way of actually achieving our ends, which have little to do with pluralism as a value. Does that make sense?
I think from the beginning, Yisrael Ahmed, no.
Okay.
Of course, Yisrael Ahmed is more sophisticated.
Yeah. Well, yeah, he just might be. What I was wondering about.
Right. I think he just might be smart enough, sophisticated enough, here's my bias, to accept pluralism. Yisrael Ahmed is less tolerant.
To accept pluralism as right and proper from an Islamic perspective,
yes,
rather than merely as the means by which to achieve
an
a non-pluralistic end.
An accommodation to non-pluralistic end. I actually believe that these are all committed Sunnis, and they will make accommodations, given no other choice. But you never really know. Okay, I interviewed them all, and they told me what they wanted to tell me. Okay? You never really know until 50 years after the fact when you're really researching the documents.
Just to add to Michael's comments, basically, I agree with what he said. But from the Kyrgyzian perspective, like that approach out of that Christian community, it's not so much that they've come to see pluralism necessary as right and proper, but society is
not a liberal one.
No, and it's not a kind of a relativism.
Right.
It's an acceptance that that we live in a whole variety of structures in society, and that the sovereignty of God requires that you respond to God in each of those functions. So as a family in raising your kids, or as a business in being smoothly in production, and that the state has its distinct calling, and the distinct calling of the state is to do justice to all people, so that it's responsible to God to be faithful by organizing and harmonizing society and integrating society in a way that all people can flourish, whether or not they believe the right thing. And you might think they believe the wrong thing, but it's the task of the state to treat everybody fairly in that difference. And I think on that,
that's considered part of the divine ordained task.
Yeah. And I think at that level, there's a lot of room to discuss with a whole variety of different religions and perspectives about what is the task of the state then, and how do you see the central function of the state in terms of plurality. And that I think you can draw at least a lot of overlap, maybe not agreement on why you would agree to that, but that there's overlap in that understanding of the function of the state.
Well, you know, they say it's a state for the Muslim, the Muslims and the believers. And you get into what's their definition.
Yeah. Well, it is. Calvin used to argue that too, right? The state was there to uphold pious and righteous rulers who would enforce true faith. And then Ed Kuyper's break with that was, God doesn't call the state to enforce conscience. God calls the state to the task of public justice, creating public harmony, and that people are responsible for what they believe within that. They can believe right or wrong, but it's not the state's task to enforce the belief. It's the state's task is to enforce just integration of society. So it's called on the carpet before God for that, not for what people actually end up believing. So to be Christian means to deal with plurality.
Well, Javed Gamedi says the state's there to require prayer of the people. And the obligation is to pay zakat, your poor due. Shiites have a different definition of what that is, by the way. It includes kums, and it can only be given to Shiite marjas or their, effectively their leaders. The state, a Sunni state, does not fit that definition. And he talks about enjoying good and forbidding the wrong. And they all talk about that. Now, whose definition of right and wrong do you want to use? I think it's pretty clear that they go back to the Sunni definition of what that is, a major overlap with the Twelver Shiites. I think Ismailis are going to have serious problems. I don't think that the condition for Pakistani Christians is going to improve anytime soon.
But you don't hear in any of these even the beginnings of a notion similar to Kuyper's notion that the state's responsibility, its responsibility as the servant of the of God, is to provide a context where all of God's creation, no matter what they believe, no matter how they behave, I mean, there are things to be done about behavior, of course, but that they are given a context in which to flourish.
Oh, Sharia does that. Sharia establishes peace, and the government makes sure that the good is enjoined and the wrong is forbidden.
It does it. It does it in terms of behavior.
That's right.
But what is being talked about here is a kind of recognition, if I understand correctly, a recognition that the state, as its mandate, its divine mandate, I love that term, is to see that all flourish because God has created all.
And also, I mean, of course, the state, forbids and punishes the wrong and so on. But
sure.
The key distinction is the state for the Kuyperian is to punish the politically, right? Or the so the state doesn't, all right and wrong does not fall under the jurisdiction of the state, only the just and the unjust, in political terms or legal terms. So it's not the state's business whether or not, well, directly, the state is not there to enforce right and wrong in respect of belief or in respect of private virtue or something, right? But only right and wrong in respect of public justice, right? And so that's the check on the extent of the state power to do that, right? And so, yes, of course, the state is there too.
Maybe the best is to an example, like the function of a schooling is the authority of parents to set up what kind of schooling they want for their children, their community. The state's function relative to schooling is to see that all children are educated, they all have access to the funding they need, but not to set the religious direction or ideological direction of schools. So out of this Kuyperian tradition, they've always supported a plurality of schools, whether they like the schools or not. As long as they're competent schools and the parents actually genuinely want them, they have to be treated justly, funded justly, and provided a legal framework in which they can flourish, and then they can debate about the truth about what's right, but it's the state's calling for God to make sure that that happens. And that's what it's responsible for.
Perhaps within this more pluralistic discourse, that will be forced to come about. Okay? But from the beginning, freedom of religion is freedom for Muslims to style their lives according to the dictates of Islam. That's freedom of religion. And of course, Yadama talks about this when you become a Muslim, once you accept Islam, you enter it wholeheartedly. It's a complete way of life. And this is where all of the rituals and the intellectual constructs of Sharia become obligatory for you. Perhaps within a pluralistic discourse, that will be negotiated, and plurality will effectively become part of Sharia. But for now, I believe they're suffering from the post-colonial reality where it is imposed. And this was a critique of the Orthodox Ulama. Who's Maududi? He's a journalist. He's writing these books. In 1957, at Machi Gulf, the Jamaat-e-Islami broke up. There was a dispute over leadership. And my understanding, as Pauli Nasser writes about it, was they said, we can't just be following this one person.
we have to negotiate what this is. Amin Islahi, the ideological progenitor of Javed Ghamidi, broke off. They left. Isfar Ahmed left. So there was plurality from the beginning, even though they talk in non-pluralistic terms. Does that answer your question in a satisfactory way? I'm wondering.
It paints a little more of the landscape. Mm-hmm.
Yes. I have 2 points. One of them is religious, and one of them is personal. The first point about Islam, and that's what I believe as a Muslim. Islam is a religion and a state. That's how it started, and that's how it came to Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Arguing that is not acceptable. Separating Islam from the state, you will find that everything is lost. And who will run the Sharia? The Sharia that was through the Quran, this is for you Muslims to rule, to interpret it. Yes, interpretation is totally different from one country to the other, from one society to the other. But that does not mean we cancel that part of the relation between the religion and the state. That's one thing. The other thing, why all the talk is about Pakistan and nothing about the rest of the Islamic world? Isn't it Pakistan a part of the big Islamic world?
It is. It's part of the Muslim world. And Maududi influences beyond Pakistan.
But because and all three scholars. There are many like Maududi, better and worse. And their way of interpreting the Sharia. So why, what I can see now for the past 3 or 4 years, everyone just talking about Pakistan. Why?
Why are people just talking about Pakistan? One, the United States is fighting a war there. They're very concerned about all this. It's a major center for discourse. In effect, pluralistic discourse, whereas I don't believe that the discourse is as open in many other parts of the Muslim world. You see this according to Ibrahim al-Arabi, our friend, who writes about contemporary Islamic thought. He says it in his book on contemporary Islamic thought. Scholars in the Gulf are trying to impose nothing. It's imposed. It's not discursive. I believe Pakistan is an interesting study because, in effect, it has strong institutions in their own, shall I say, authoritarian way. They are capable of having that discourse. They're sophisticated. These are cultured people. That discourse can happen. It's a potential for a pluralistic discourse, for an Islamic democracy. That's why it's interesting.
We have Nick here.
Well, I heard from time to time an antithesis between the public and the official, and the proposition that these men are public men, but they're not part of the official establishment. And I have we've heard about the state, but I have a feeling that there's probably in this system of thought a certain antipathy to the state as we understand it, and a preference perhaps for some concept of society. This is also, of course, a trend that has been visible in Christianity many times over the centuries. But I have to say that I'm a defender of the state. I don't think you can get anywhere without the state. And I just wonder whether all of this debate is not going to have to come around to face the inevitability of the state. And the state has its own way of enforcing things. It, some states have a mechanism for pluralism, but it's a hard fight. Would you like to comment on that? Islam itself, I wonder whether it's really set up for a state system.
All Islamic reform movements or revival movements have accepted the existence of a state. They work with a state. Javed Ghamidi just comes out and says it. These are intellectual constructs from the modern period. If you look at the classical school, these didn't exist within classical Islam, but there is an impetus amongst Muslims to create a society of justice, to create a government that enjoins good and forbids wrong, which requires morality of people, which creates an Islamic society. I believe his critique is accurate, as is Muhammad Khalid Massoud's, that this ideology of the state is something that was tissued together in the 20th century. Before that, there was a ruler, a sultan. There were caliphates. There was always a political system within Islam, which claimed to have the approval of the ulama. You saw this in the Ottoman Empire. So there has to be some way of, if 69% of the Pakistani people want a society based on Quran and Sunnah, there has to be some way of working with the state that effectuates the society that they want. And what Javed Ghamidi is saying is, it's not necessarily the ideology of Abu Ala Mahdi.
Mumtaz Ahmad, quoting I think the same study, said that although that's the case, they want Sharia, a large number of them. If you then turn around and ask them, as his institute did, do they want him to chop hands off? They say no. So what do they mean by that response? They mean social justice. That was his argument in any case. So it's always interesting how these are positioned. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.